Welcome to the Teaching Journeys podcast, hosted by Dave Roberts. Humanity possesses a unique skill, the ability to pass knowledge from one generation to the next. This podcast embraces that ability, offering learning opportunities through conversations with extraordinary guests. Dave aims to leave a positive mark on individuals around the world. So before you dive into today's episode, please share this podcast with your network, including friends, family, and colleagues. And please consider leaving a rating or review. Your support makes all the difference.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to another episode of the Teaching Journeys podcast. I'm your host, Dave Roberts. And today it is my pleasure to have as my guest, John Turk. Let me tell you a little bit about John. John Turk earned a PhD in organic chemistry in 1971 and was nominated by National Geographic as one of the top 10 adventurers of the year in 2012. Between these bookends, John co-authored the first college-level environmental science textbook in North America, followed by 30 additional texts in environmental, physical, and earth sciences. At the same time, he kayaked around Cape Horn and across the North Pacific from Japan to Alaska, mountain biked across the northern Gobi in Mongolia, and made numerous first ski descents and first rock climbing ascents around the globe. During extended travel in Northeast Siberia, John's worldview was altered by Mulianat, a Siberian shaman, and his later books reflect those spiritual journeys. John has published 4 trade books, Cold Oceans, In the Wake of the Shaman, The Raven's Gift, and Crocodiles and Ice. His most recent project, Tracking Lines, Myth, and Wilderness in Samburu, which was published by Rocky Mountain Books in September of 2021, delves more deeply into a mind-body-spirit theme, supported by adventure storytelling, integrated with an anthropological view of the role of art and mythology in human development. For more information about John, see www.johnturk.net. John, welcome to the Teaching Journeys podcast. It is a pleasure having you on the show today.
Okay, Dave, it's a pleasure to be here with you.
I found The Raven's Gift, which is going to be one of probably the many topics we're going to get into for the time that we have, through pure serendipity. I was visiting my son Matt and his daughter-in-law Jody in Colorado, where they live. And we went to just it was probably just like a general store type of setting. They had crystals and a variety of different books, paperbacks, variety of different other objects. And I'm looking in their book section, and I see this book called The Raven's Gift. And I was intrigued because Raven has showed me her magic in trying times for me during the last 14 years. And when I saw the premise of the book, I said, I've got to get this book. I bought it. I read it. And the next thing I said is, I got to reach out to John and see if he'd be willing to be a guest on the podcast to talk about The Raven's Gift and other related issues. And so here we are. And I'm just grateful for your presence today. First, the first thing I got to ask you is, what gave you the call to be the adventurer that you are? What inspired you to take that path in your life?
Well, that was deep inside of me. I think about that all the time. But before I remember, when I just learned how to walk, my mother tells me, I don't remember this, I was a toddler. We grew up in Brooklyn, New York. As soon as I could walk, I would run away from home, run down the street. There was a vacant lot at the corner, at the end of the street. And my mother, in a panic, oh, where's Johnny? Where's Johnny? Oh, my God. And then she would run around looking for me and run down the block and would see the grass moving because I was shorter than the grass. And she would see the grass moving around, and then she would run and find me and catch me and bring me home. So there was something inside of me, which I can't explain, which I won't try to explain, that wanted to be that person wandering through the tall grass. Now, my upbringing, my father was a chemist. Both of my parents were PhDs. My upbringing was to become a scholar of some kind. And I went to a fancy New England prep school, Ivy League college, graduate school, got my PhD. And then I went, I want to be that little boy walking through the tall grass. And the day, the moment, I know that moment when I made that transition, I was in a high alpine meadow in the Colorado Mountains. I was going to school in Boulder, Colorado. And it was springtime. The snow was melting. The grass was coming up. The flowers, the first of the spring alpine flowers, were coming out. And my dog went berserk. And she started running around and digging holes in the meadow, in the dirt, and stuffing her nose in the hole and smelling the earth. And something just jolted inside me. And I ran after my dog, and she had dug one hole. Now she was racing off to dig another hole. And I stuck my face in the hole, and my whole ring of my face was covered with this moist dirt. And I was smelling the earth and smelling all the nematodes and ribosomes and bacteria and fungi and roots and everything coming to life. And I spent the afternoon smelling the earth. And then I went, I have to be that boy who spends his life walking through the tall grass. And that was it. I finished my PhD because I was well on the way. And I'm not a person who gives up along the way. And then I walked out, stuffed my diploma in the glove box of a 64 Ford Fairlane, and went in north into the Arctic.
I think sometimes, I think at a young age, our soul kind of knows what our calling is. And sometimes it takes a little while for us to catch up to what our soul is calling us to do. But once we do, you know, we just find our path and we just follow that. I know there's not a lot of tall grass in Siberia. I can't imagine that there is. But what drew you to Siberia specifically? I know you've been there five times, John, as I recall from our conversation.
Six.
Six? Okay.
Six, yeah.
What drew you specifically to Siberia? What was the attraction to that part of the world?
Well, I was drawn to long-distance expedition sea kayaking, that interaction where you put yourself into the jaws of one of the most powerful forces of the earth in one of the most vulnerable ways you can be, and then you survive. And that became something that I loved to do. So what I would do is take out maps and look for the most uninhabited coastlines in the world. And I've dedicated a big chunk of my life to exploring those uninhabited coastlines where I could kayak in deep wilderness. Siberia is it.
And that was the setting, really, for one of the, I would call it, from my perception, one of the most magical experiences that I've read about. And that segues us into the Raven's Gift. Could you tell our listeners a little bit about what the Raven's Gift's about and what you would want our readers or our listeners to take away from it if they choose to read it?
Yeah. Thank you, Dave. Well, I was involved in a two-year expedition to paddle from Japan to Alaska, basically across the Pacific Ocean in a production off-the-shelf kayak. And that followed the arc of the Pacific Rim. So it was in the second year, we were late. What does late mean out there in the wilderness? It means that if we lingered too long, winter would come, the ocean would freeze, and we would die. So it was a real form of lateness. So we were paddling. There was a little village, a little fishing village along the coast. And we were paddling. It was early in the afternoon. And my partner, Misha, looked at me. I looked at him. Should we stop early? And we said, no, we got to keep going. And just then, out of the blue, no indication on my barometer watch, no lenticular clouds, a storm descended. And the wind started to blow, and the waves started to rise up, and the wind was picking the water up and blowing it into the air, and the waves were blowing into the water, and the water of rain was blowing in, and it was mayhem. And so we looked at each other and said, well, we better go to town after all. And so we went in through the surf, got out of our boats, and you know, you're kind of creaky, you've been in the boat for a long time, you're wet, you're cold. And this woman walks up, Lydia, big woman, a Koryak woman, in a big Russian peasant coat with a dog fur cap, and she speaks in English. And she says, welcome. It's good to see you. We were expecting you. The grandmother brought you to this village because she wants to talk to you. Dum, 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 dum. I was a chemist. I went to high school with George W. Bush. I have a training in physical sciences. What do I make of this?
Mm-hmm.
I'm also a traveler. A traveler, there's no space in a traveler's lexicon for questioning, for criticism, for just being negative. So I mean, there was a storm out there. There's a warm house in there. I could smell bread baking. I said, wonderful, wonderful. We'd love to see the grandmother. And that started 5 years of intensive time in this village with the grandmother. And that's the basis for the book, The Raven's Gift.
Yeah. And when I first read that part in the book where Lydia had said, well, you know, grandmother arranged the storm because she wanted to meet you, probably, John, 20 years ago or even 14 years ago, I would have questioned that because I have a background in psychology, and I used to believe that unless I could experience behavior and events with my five senses, it didn't exist. I didn't make room for the magic in my life. I didn't make room for spiritual phenomenon in my life. But, you know, tragedy occurred in my life that compelled me to take a look at everything I stood for and question what I believed with the help of a very influential interfaith minister by the name of Reverend Patty Farino, facilitated a spiritually transformative experience that helped me find peace after my own tragedy. But before that, I just believed that science explained everything. But now as I've come to understand, there's certain things for me that I believe are real that necessarily science can't explain, but I know them to be real. And to me, that pays homage to the magic that is at our disposal from the universe, as long as we are open to receiving that magic and looking at that to hopefully expand our belief system and perhaps transform our perspective.
Well, thank you. We're on the same page, Dave. Scientists coming to understand, not just believe, but to appreciate that there's another realm of possibility out there, which we can call magic.
Now, I know in the book you described a very intense experience. A lot of people would call it a healing experience that you had with Moulinat. Can you elaborate on that a little more for our listeners?
Okay, thank you. Yeah, back in my life back in North America, I'm a skier, and I was caught in an avalanche at one point, a severe avalanche, and broke my pelvis, severe injury, and I was bolted back together by an orthopedic surgeon in Calgary. And everything was fine for a few years. And then I started having this episodic pain where it would just, I couldn't walk. There were days where I could not walk. So I went to the surgeon and I said, well, you know, I'm planning to go to Siberia to talk to the old grandmother, you know, and he said, no. But I went anyway. And she sent us on some sort of a vision quest out on the tundra and also a practical quest to find reindeer people and reindeer meat to initiate old trade routes. We brought frozen salmon and we were expected to come back with reindeer meat, which we did. And it took longer on the tundra. This is a big space. It's 9 time zones between Moscow and Eastern Russia. And we had trouble finding the reindeer people. And it was now springtime and the creeks were melting. And we had to cross these semi-frozen creeks. We dropped a snow machine through the ice and I was wrestling the snow machine out of the ice. Expedition work. And I slipped on a rock and tweaked my pelvis, and boom, I couldn't walk. And I'm lying on the snow, and I cannot stand up. And at that moment, if you had given me a cell phone and I could have dialed 911 and called a helicopter, Dave, I would have done it. Mm-hmm. But that was not an option. So my friends, Oleg and Sergei, the Koryak friends, godsons of Mulanot, the shaman, the grandmother, they were unconcerned. They were, we'll tie you on the sled, we'll take you home, and the grandmother will heal you. Okay. So they tied me on the sled, and we started heading home, and then, oh my gosh, there's good fishing over there. We'll go over there and we'll go fishing for a couple of days and bring fish home to the grandmother. And now we're going to have fish and reindeer meat. And this is not an ambulance or a helicopter rushing me to the hospital. So we get back to the village. And by this time, it's been some days and I can walk and stand and I'm starting to get better, but still in quite a lot of pain. And the grandmother, they tell the grandmother my problem, and she says, well, that's no worry. You paid for the gas. You brought reindeer meat and food back to the village. You're a contributor, and I'll heal you. So she has me take off all my clothes, stand on one leg, one arm out in front, one arm behind my back. And I've been told later that that's the crane pose, the pose of flight, to fly to the other world. And she spits on my pubic hair. She rubs me with rabbit fur and she starts singing to call Kutha, the messenger god, the raven. And she tells me, Kutha will fly to the woman who lives on top of the highest mountain, and the woman on top of the highest mountain will heal you. But you have to believe. And if you don't believe, bad things are going to happen. Well, here I am again. At the risk of repeating myself, I'm a chemist. I went to high school with George W. Bush. My mother never taught me to believe in Kutha. And I couldn't lie to the grandmother. I told her, I will try. I will try with all my heart. And that was sufficient. And the grandmother continued to sing and talk to Kutha. And I'm standing on one leg with one arm behind my back and so forth. And then some time passes. I don't know. I have no idea how much time. And then she says, you can stand now. The old woman who lives on top of the highest mountain has healed you. You're better. And I was.
What was your initial reaction when that happened? What went through your mind once you had an opportunity to process what had happened?
Well, thank you. My mind stopped analyzing. At that moment, I had just been on a journey to see Kutha in the other world, And my cerebral cortex and my questioning cortex and my science cortex was not operating. I was just thankful. And the next day, we were going off into the tundra with my team, Misha and my wife, Chris, and Oleg and Sergey. And we were on skis. And we were skiing behind the snow machines. And I started skate skiing. Chris, my wife, grabbed me by the elbow and said, "John, do you know what you're doing?" I said, "Yeah, I'm skating down the snow machine track." She said, "John, you have not skate skated since your injury. This is the first time, because skate skiing involves pushing in that pelvic motion." She says, "This is the first time you have skate skated since your avalanche." And I had no conscious recollection, no conscious thought that that's what I was doing. I was still in the other world.
And you remain completely healed today.
I'm 79, and since then I've skied a lot of big lines and rock climbed, and now I'm living in the desert and riding my mountain bike every day, and I've been completely healed.
That is an amazing, magical story. And when I was reading the account of what Mulyadat did for you, based on my own integrative belief system now, where I believe science and spirituality together can give us a greater understanding of ourselves and the world around us. And in some cases, where science can't explain events that are real, but we know them to be real. I was just in awe of reading about your experience. I was inspired just reading it, and it just reaffirms my belief that we are infinitesimally small in comparison to what the universe has to offer. And it was just great. Now, my understanding is after you were still on the search for Kutka, am I correct? You were still looking to offer thanks to the Raven God for the healing. Am I correct?
Yeah. And we came back. So we go home back at the end of that experience. We go home back to North America. And now I start thinking. I start trying to put this together. And I don't make any sense of it. My spiritual beliefs and my scientific beliefs clash, and I don't make any sense of it. So we go back to the village. And this is no small feat. There's no roads to this village. You take some very long airplane flights, and then you walk, or you ski, or you snow machine, or you kayak to the village, in an effort to thank Kutka. Oh, and we bring presents. We bring presents to the grandmother to thank the grandmother. Actually, my initial thing was, I'm thanking the grandmother. I forgot to thank Kutka. And I give the grandmother all these presents, warm clothes and nice knife and stuff like that. And she squirrels them into her bag, and she said, "Well, thank you for the presents, but I'm the wrong person to thank." I didn't do anything. I just talked to Kutka. And I say, "Okay, well, what do I have to do now?" She says, "You have to thank Kutka." But actually, Kutka is just the messenger. It's the old lady who lives on top of the highest mountain that healed you, and you have to thank her. Now I'm totally over my head, Dave. I mean, how do I thank the woman who lives on top of the highest mountain? How do I communicate with Kutka? And all of that. And so over the next several years, this doesn't come out slowly, I become involved with communicating with Kutcha and going to the other world or not to thank the woman who lives on top of the highest mountain.
Did you ever make it to the other world?
No. Well, yes and no. Many adventures and things pass, and Mulanat decides that I need to eat some of the Amanita mushroom, the hallucinogenic mushroom, and the hallucinogenic mushroom will aid me to travel to the other world. Okay? And not only that, but she has a mushroom that she went out on the tundra and it jumped up and said, I am the mushroom for John to take him to the other world. So this is my special mushroom. You eat this. You will go to the other world. You can thank the woman who lives on top of the highest mountain. So I eat the mushroom. And now, this is a hallucinogenic drug. There's no question about it. I'm sitting in a chair, and in my hallucinogenic dream world, I'm entering a cavern, a labyrinth, that will take me to the other world. And this has all kinds of mythological background as well. And I'm trudging through the labyrinth, and there are branches, and I turn left and turn right and turn left and turn right. And then I see a spot of light. And that's the other world. And I go, oh boy, this has been a long walk, but I'm getting there. And I walk along and I'm walking. And the spot is getting bigger and the labyrinth is starting to glow. And then I get terrified, absolutely terrified. I do not have the power. Once I cross that threshold, I am absolutely convinced I do not have the power to come back. And I turn around and run back through the labyrinth and get lost and have this terrible experience. And I get out. And when I come back out of this experience, this dream, this journey, whatever you want to call it, Mulanat is gone. I'm alone in the room. I go to sleep and I wake up in the morning and I have a huge sense of failure. I was instructed, I was given the opportunity to go on this journey, and I failed to complete it because I didn't have the courage. And I had this sense of failure, and I was sitting in Lydia and Oleg's kitchen drinking tea and having breakfast and feeling bad. And Oleg, the hunter, walks in his tundra clothes, in his fur coat, in his dog fur hat. And he says, pack up, get your sleeping bag, let's go. We're going out on the tundra to go hunting. It's November, and this is time to get the last bit of food for the old people in the village who will be hungry. And it's November in Siberia, and it's starting to get cold. We go out on the tundra, and nobody has talked to me about my failure, my failed journey. And I don't know who to talk to about. I don't know how to communicate my issue. And we go out and we gather food for the old people in the village because we're the hunters. We fill the boat up. We were fishing in the river and hunting, and we fill the boat up with food. And we're coming back down the river, and Oleg kills the engine. And he says, John, do you know why you were afraid to enter the other world? And it's like, oh, no, I don't know why. I was just afraid. And he says, well, John, you're a really good traveler in the real world. Every person has a certain amount of power. One person doesn't have all the power. A person has their power, their personal power. You are not a good traveler. You're a lousy traveler in the other world, but a good traveler in the real world. If you want to talk to Kutcha, you have to go out on the tundra in the winter when it's cold, get frostbitten, get hungry, face danger, and Kutcha will come and talk to you. I guarantee it. And so when you say, you asked me, you started this with the question, did you journey to the other world? And my first reaction was no. But my second reaction, when I think about it a little more, is the dream world and the real world are the same. We live in the dream world. Yes, I did travel to the other world on the tundra.
Absolutely. And you did end up finding Kutcha. Am I correct?
Yeah, we did finally get to Kutcha. We got to thank Kutcha. And from then on in, Kutcha has been my spirit animal and my friend.
And what were the circumstances that allowed you to find Kutcha or Kutcha to find you?
Well, my dear wife, Chris, who was my companion, my wife, my friend, my companion on many of these trips, she died tragically in an avalanche. And there's a lot of grief that goes on with that, a lot of pain. I decided to take her ashes to the top of a mountain that she loved to ski, the highest mountain in Fernie, British Columbia, where we spent our winters. So we put the ashes in a pack, and I was joined by Chris's sister. And we got on the high ridge. We were getting to the peak, and one of the major ski lines didn't come right off the peak, but off of the shoulder. It was a line that Chris just absolutely loved to ski, a beautiful mountain line. And as I'm walking along the ridge, a raven comes. And it acted exactly as the raven had acted in Siberia. It hovered over me, shaking its wings, kind of lowered like a helicopter till it was an arm's length above my head. And then it did something different. It skied Chris's line. What do I mean by skied the line? It was summertime. It was August. There was no snow. It dropped down to maybe waist level, and it made turns and followed the contour of the mountain all the way down to the bottom. And then, just in case I didn't get the point, it flew up, hovered, came within a hand's reach of the top of my head, and skied the mountain again.
Yeah, I mean, you can't dispute that. And particularly, I know Ted Andrews in his book, Animal Speak, says that any animal sighting is significant. But if there's an animal that's just like really comes right out in front of you and makes themselves known to you very, you know, very boldly, they have a message that's specifically for you, or they're trying to make a point. And Kutcha is saying, yeah, it's me.
Yeah.
I've had similar experiences. And I talked to you about, or sent you a piece that I wrote about my cat Bootsy when he transitioned, who was my late daughter Janine's favorite cat. And, you know, after we buried him in the backyard, three crows were singing his praises. And I said a prayer to Crow to, you know, just take a message of love to Bootsy and tell him how much he taught me and how much he meant to me and my family. And three crows started flying off in the distance. So, you know, when I read that, I just said, yeah, I get it, because I've seen it. And the other thing, you know, we talk about grief. What One of the things I learned about crows is they're omnivores. They will take what the earth gives them, whether it's grain, whether it's vegetation, whether it's meat. And it teaches, I think, us as humans to learn to be adaptable and to be flexible and also be resilient, but be grateful for what the earth has to give us and not question that and just take whatever sustenance we can to help us get through the next step in our journeys, particularly journeys after loss.
Well, resilience is a key element in life for sure, Dave.
Yep.
And grief is normal. Animals exhibit grief. Many, many examples. A mother orca carries her dead baby, and a million examples. Integrated with our grief, there's the resilience. The raven, Kutha, recognized my grief and then skied the line and showed the joy, that there's joy. So there's grief and joy, and that's the mixture. The grief never goes away, but the joy should never go away either.
I think to live an authentic existence, we have to experience every emotion in the emotional spectrum. We contain all the emotions that humanity could possibly experience, so we can mirror that for each other and be in service to each other because we're authentically sharing that, we're authentically displaying that. I don't hang around with totally happy people. I don't hang around with individuals who believe that happiness only is the key to fulfillment. I think getting in touch with everything that is our emotional experience gives us authenticity, helps us develop compassion, helps us develop empathy, and genuineness.
Well, compassion and empathy go a long way. And I think what's come out of this, all of these experiences happened 20 or so years ago. I'm 79 now, so that's squeaking awful close to 80 by my arithmetic. And I've given up trying to explain what happened to me. I spent some time trying to fit it into various structures, scientific structures, spiritual structures, religious structures. And I've kind of given up that explanation search. But what has lingered strong, boom, unquestioning, is that magic exists, that the world is magical. The world isn't necessarily fair, but it's magical along the way. And yes, bad things can happen to good people. That's been said many, many times by many teachers. But throughout it all, there's magic. And once you believe in magic, and the thing about magic is magic doesn't linger. It's always in motion. Mm-hmm. And if magic comes your way and you don't embrace it, then it's gone.
Yeah.
And that moment is gone. And that bit of magic that fills your soul, you missed it. So what that means is that your whole world, your whole being, I mean, we all fall off the wagon. I'm not saying it happens every minute of every day, but there's a belief inside me that the world is magical. Mm. And that every moment there's magic if I catch it. And if I don't touch it, it's not magical. It's my choice.
Absolutely. And, you know, one of the things you talked about, honoring the magic and honoring the mystery, it reminds me of a quote that I found in a book by Kent Nerburn, who's another one of my favorite writers. He wrote a book called The Voices in the Stones, Life Lessons from the Native Way. And he quoted a Lakota elder who said, life isn't a puzzle to be solved. it's a mystery to be honored. And I love that quote because it really alludes to the fact that don't question the magic in the universe. Just embrace it, be in awe of it, and let it inspire you. And the other thing is, I can't conceptually validate somebody else's mystical experience. I can't say, well, I don't believe it happened because I'm not in your skin, and I can't really say that for sure. But what I can do is attempt to understand, tell me what happened, tell me the impact it had on your worldview, tell me how it affected, did you find peace? But the bottom line is that, you know, let's just be in awe of the magic that the universe has to behold. And that was, I think, I saw a talk that you did, I think, for the College of the Atlantic about 14 years ago. And I think in that talk, you cited an email that you received from a civil engineer who said you didn't believe the healing experience that you had with Molyneux. And you had a very interesting answer for him. And I think it was related to just behold the magic that's in the universe. And, you know, don't question the actual experience. Just look at the magic that was involved. And look at what it did for me. Look at how it just inspired me and helped me find peace or altered my worldview or caused me to take a look at things differently than I could have otherwise.
Thank you, Dave. I appreciate that. And we sure need peace and compassion in the world today.
For sure. What can the indigenous people teach us about how we can maybe live in a more peaceful world? What can we learn from the indigenous cultures that we can take into the society?
Well, the huge difference between the original Aboriginal knowledge and worldview and the Western knowledge and worldview is that the Aboriginal knowledge and worldview was intimately integrated with nature. And the Western European worldview is intimately integrated with science and technology. So you and I are talking on a computer, a magical device that transmits sound and imagery and video in ways that we can't understand across the cyberspace. We fly in airplanes. When I'm in an airplane, I'm really glad that some very clever engineer designed the rivets to hold the wing to the fuselage so it doesn't fall off. So I will not in any way disparage science or engineering, but it's only part of the picture. Science and engineering does not give us peace directly. It does not give us peace, compassion, understanding, wholeness inside of us. And so what we have to learn from the Aboriginal people is that integration, that learning and appreciation of nature. In Russia, in Canada, in the United States, when the Europeans took over the Aboriginal communities, in all of those countries, they took the children out of their environment, away from their language, away from their families, out of their home, away from the reindeer or the buffalo or the salmon, and put them in schools and made them sit in a chair in a square room and learn reading, writing, and arithmetic. Now, Molyneux and all the Koryak people have told me that no one, zero people who spent their formative years sitting on a chair in a square room learning, reading, and writing and arithmetic have been able to achieve the power of the ancients. Zero. So for me to say, well, I can jump that gap and achieve that wisdom, that's not true. And I'm finding personally from all of these experiences that my final journey, like I say, I'm 79, I'm headed out the door, man. My final journey is to live as much as I can in nature. And I pretty much, I had an apartment here and there. I sold all that stuff. I live in a van. I mean, I'm not in a teepee. I'm not riding a horse, but I live in a van, and I live this 2024, 8 months of the year, camping out. And slowly, that magic comes. It's not going to be fast, but it's going to be continuous.
It will occur in its own time, at its own pace, and its own trajectory.
Yeah. And just a few days ago, the moon was rising, the sun was setting, and this aurora cactus in the sky was all orange, and I was there for it.
Yeah, and I think once we open ourselves up to the magic of the universe, it finds us, because we know that we make that a part of our everyday existence.
Yeah, and so, yeah, the wisdom is to learn from nature, appreciate nature, learn of its foibles, its, you know, it gets cold and hot and avalanches and storms and hurricanes and things, and to appreciate it enough to, we have to take some from nature to live, to survive. Every organism has to eat, but to take with respect and give with respect.
Absolutely. It's working collaboratively and cooperatively with nature as opposed to working exploitively with nature.
Yeah. You know, a bulldozer is a pretty crude device.
Mm-hmm.
We can live with nature without the bulldozer so much.
Absolutely. And you know, your desire to continue to live in nature. I was reading your most recent book, Tracking Lions, Myth, and Wilderness in Samburu, and I found something towards the end of your book. I just happened to just randomly pick out a page, and this stuck out. You said that nature always surrounds us, providing wonder and solace if we only open our hearts to the wonder around us.
Well, thank you. Thank you for finding that.
And also, you also indicated, I think, on that same page that wilderness is my greatest teacher.
Absolutely. And it's not going to teach me quantum mechanics, but it's going to give me wisdom every day.
Mm-hmm. And like you, I don't disparage science. I just invite other perspectives to give me a greater understanding of the world around me, in addition to science.
Yeah. It's,
you know, one, I think the misconceptions, John, and I mentioned this to my students, is that if they begin to entertain a belief that's different from their core beliefs, the myth is that they have to abandon their core beliefs to make room for that belief. So they don't need to do that. You know, they could just, in addition to their core beliefs, they can pick and choose different perspectives that resonate with them. And that's the basis for critical thinking.
Yeah, and it's just an opening. It's becoming larger than you were before.
Absolutely. You know, during our phone conversation, you mentioned something that you wanted to emphasize on the podcast. Can you elaborate on that a little more for our listeners?
Well, thanks, Dave. Yeah, I wanted to go there. So, Dave, about 5 million years ago, in certain lineages of great apes, there was an evolutionary experiment. Evolution is by chance. And that experiment was to create an ape with a bigger brain. And the brain started growing bigger, and that gives us advantages. But the brain is a very costly metabolic organism. It uses a lot of oxygen. Every gram of brain tissue uses 5 times as much oxygen as a gram of muscle tissue. So as these apes became smarter, they became weaker. And as it turned out, that over the millennia, that turned out to be not a good trade-off. And these smarter and smarter apes became less and less numerous. They were losing the evolutionary battle to stay alive. And then around 70,000 years ago, all of a sudden, the population of now hominins, Homo sapiens, exploded. Homo sapiens were almost extinct. And then, boom, the population exploded. What caused that explosion? Well, according to the best anthropology, it was not advanced tools. Now, let me be clear. Simple tools, a hand axe, a stone that was flaked to a point that you hold in your hand, they were around. We were using tools. But advanced tools, the bow and arrow, the atlatl, the spear, they were not around. And what happened 70,000 years ago is that we started creating art. And art was the foundation of our success. And tools came secondary. We developed art. We saw magic. We embraced it. We came together as community. Along with the art came storytelling around the fireside, came rituals, came music, came dancing, came togetherness, came joy. And then when we had that cooperation, that unity among us, we were able to exchange ideas and, we could do this a little better. And all of a sudden, the tools came. So when we sit in school and they tell us, we're going to cut the budget for music and we're going to cut the budget for art because you have to learn reading and writing arithmetic, that's backwards, you see. We have to learn cooperation. We have to learn love. We have to learn embrace storytelling, being together, dancing.
And you know who could be our greatest teachers for that? Our indigenous cultures.
That's correct. And that's where we're going.
And that's a transition that I know I probably won't live to see, but from wherever I'm at, I'll be smiling knowing that that transformation has taken place, because that's, I think, if we can get back to that cooperation, inclusiveness through the arts, through creativity, through finding common ground with individuals who we may perceive as being different than us, an ideology or culture, it's going to make the world a more peaceful planet. And we're going to get back to the way it was when the indigenous people first inhabited this earth.
Thank you.
You're welcome. John, is there any other takeaways that you want to leave our listeners with tonight?
Yeah, I'd like to hold up the Raven's Gift and encourage people to read it.
Flip my copy, too.
I'd like to say that I enjoy communication with people who listen to me speak. My website is johnturk.net. My email is john@johnturk.net. If you send me an email, I will answer and we can have dialogue.
And trust me, John answers emails very quickly. A man close to my heart, because I tell my students, when you email me, I will answer you within 24 hours. Your responsiveness was impressive to me, and I know it'll be impressive to anybody who contacts you.
Unless I'm camped in a canyon and we don't have internet service for a few days.
That's possible, because I could be talking to you 5 months from now and you could be at some different part of the world.
Yeah. And if you don't hear from me, say, John's in some beautiful canyon and he's doing zero screen time for a few days, but he will reappear.
And for me, one other thing I wanted to mention, out of the many things I'd gotten out of the Ravens gift, including not only your experience, but your conversations with the Koryak cult people, documenting their stories, their culture. This one quote that I absolutely love that I think sums up everything we probably talked about the wonders of the universe: healing, magic, hope, acceptance.
Thank you. I'll add three words to that, that the power of the Koryak people is the hunter, the shaman, and the tundra.
All three essential elements for not only survival, but for thriving and for building resilience.
Exactly. Yeah, and I like that you keep using that word resilience, Dave. I'll keep that in mind.
Thank you, John. And thank you so much for being just a great guest contributor today to the Teaching Journeys podcast. I enjoyed our conversation. Hope we can have more in the future.
Thank you, Dave. Good night.
Good night. And with that, that is a wrap on another episode of the Teaching Journeys podcast. I'm your host, Dave Roberts, wishing you peace.